Good evening, everyone. This is week 9, the final week of this course on mindfulness that I've been teaching. And tonight we get to the final thing in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. I'll read it first to you. The words are quite simple and the implication is quite deep. So this is the final, so if we think of the Dhammas in the fourth foundation of mindfulness as progressive, you know, we're starting with dealing with the kilesas, with obstructions, and then last week we talked about the seven factors of awakening, like we're moving towards awakening, and then Buddha says, and then this, here's where we end in a sense, right? He says, he knows as it really is. This is dukkha. She knows as it really is. This is the arising of dukkha. He knows as it really is. This is the cessation of dukkha. She knows as it really is. This is the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. So it's the Four Noble Truths. But expressed in a different way. And that's what I want to talk about mainly for the rest of. I mean, the very first thing the Buddha taught, the very first thing when he reached his enlightenment and he went off and he found those guys he used to hang out in the forest with, the very first thing he taught was the Four Noble Truths. So it was like the beginning of everything, right? And here it is, it's the end of everything. And when I first encountered this, I was like, how curious that, you know, this, you know, the Four Noble Truths wasn't at the beginning of this sutta someplace, right? Why is it, what's it doing here at the end? But what the Buddha is pointing to here is everything else is in the sutta, everything else in the teachings of mindfulness leads to this, leads to knowing as it really is. This is dukkha. You know, this is, and notice the words there are, is knowing. It's not understanding. It's not contemplating. It's not figuring out. It's knowing. He's pointing to that in the end, everything else that we've been doing, you know, once we have an equanimous mind, when we reach the end of the seven factors of awakening, what we then see as it really is dukkha. We now take it in not as some intellectual idea or some sort of, well, isn't it just in the kind of cool? Now it's like, oh, this is what is. He knows as it really is. So he's pointing to the fact that we have to live. We have to, as we live our lives, approach everything with this knowledge at its our base, as opposed to this sort of interesting idea, something we might think about sometimes. And so he's pointing to insight. You know, we have to have insight into the Four Noble Truths. We can't think about them or figure them out. We have to have insight into them. We have to know them in some deep, internal, non-intellectual way. And how can we? So the first thing, you know, in our lives and our practice, the big question then becomes, well, first of all, what does he mean by dukkha? What is it really all about? You know, you hear it translated as suffering. You hear it translated as unsatisfactoriness. Various other stress. I even heard it translated lately as stress, which seems too soft by far for me. But what is it that we need to know? And there's this wonderful teaching called the Five Remembrances that I keep coming back to. And this is like something you could contemplate daily. This is something you could, you know, put on your fridge to remind yourself. One of my teachers at one point said, you should, every time you sit, the first thing you should think of do is recite the five remembrances to yourself as a reminder. This is, we're heading towards knowing this, not as some intellectual idea, but as the truth. And so I just want to read you the five remembrances first. First one is, I'm sure to become old. I cannot avoid aging. Second one is, I'm sure to become ill. I cannot avoid illness. The third one, I'm sure to die. I cannot avoid death. Fourth one, I must be separated and parted from all that is dear and beloved to me. Can't, boils down to that old phrase, you can't take it with you. Right? And then the fifth one is, I'm the owner of my actions. I'm the heir of my actions. Actions are my relations. Actions are my protection. Whatever actions I do, good or bad, all of these I shall become the heir. So he's pointing to the law of karma. Whatever we do with intention has results. And so we have to be very precise about what we do to generate the wholesome results that lead to our onward leading. But all of these, especially the first four, all point to the same thing. They point to everything's impermanent, including you, Barry. Wake up. You know, this is the truth. And this is to know as it really is, this is dukkha. And know as it really is, this is the reality moment to moment. It isn't something that's sort of some off time, off in the distant future, maybe someday this will happen. This is moment to moment reality. That's what I think that's what he means when he says we have to know it as it really is, that this is like right in the next moment. Right in the next moment, we're gone. Just like that. Or something happens. Who knows? We don't know. We keep thinking, oh, you know, I got a lot of good years left, or I got this, or I got that. We don't have a clue. And it's like, as long as we think that, yeah, all those things are true, but later, then we don't know dukkha as it really is, which is in the present moment. And the problem is, it sounds like, boy, this is really sort of grim and depressing. You know, this is really like, come on, who wants to think about this stuff? You know, I want to think about the good stuff, right? Let's talk about joy. And the beauty of this is that when we really absorb these five remembrances, and we really absorb the truth of it all that we keep ignoring, it frees us. Oh, why be afraid of these things when they're going to happen anyway? They're bound to happen, so why bother being afraid? It's not like I can control the fact that, well, I'm going to be different than everybody else. None of this is going to happen to me. We know. We see it all around us every day. This is going to happen. And so we can stop worrying about it. It's just what's going to happen. Guaranteed. Everyone. And so the first three are pointing directly to the nature of this body. You know, the impermanent, changing, gradually deteriorating nature of this body. This is the way bodies are. Right? The fourth one I must be separated and parted from all that is dear and beloved to me. He's pointing here to our tendency to sort of gather things and collect things and get more stuff. You know, and then at some point, what are you going to do with all that stuff? You know, what's going to happen to all that stuff? How can you take care of it later on? But we don't think that. We think, oh no, I want to get, I like this and I like that, and I really like that painting and I like this, and that person I'm really close to, I want to keep that person around all the time. It's all gonna go. You know, I'm part of a group of people who sit with people who are dying at the hospital, and it's always the same. In the end, it's always the same. There's a person lying in the bed, and literally all that's happening most of the time is they're still breathing. That's it. All their stuff, who knows where that stuff is or what is going to happen to it? It's gone. As far as they're concerned, it's gone. Because all they have left is breath, literally. You know, and that's like the automatic functions of the body that say, no, I'm not going to stop breathing yet. I'm going to keep breathing because that's my job, to keep breathing. And the organs of the body function and keep the breath going for a while. And then it just stops. It's the nature. And then at that point, you got nothing. Everything you accumulated, all the great things and all that money you put away and all those great stuff you have and all those wonderful people that are a part of your life, they're all gone. And I'm not saying for one second, and this is really important, that you shouldn't enjoy this life as it is and have friends and have stuff that makes you happy. Wouldn't for a second deny that. But have all those things. What the Buddha is pointing to is we have to understand that it's okay to have all those things as long as we don't feel like we can take them with us, as long as we don't get attached to them. Because they're, not only am I going to go, but all that stuff is going to go. All those people are going to go. You know, I'm at the age where people I know keep passing away. I've lost several friends in the last 3-4 years. Those nice people, now they're gone. And that's the nature of life. It's just what is. And this is the other thing that, you know, we think, oh, well, you know, if that's what's going to cause me to suffer, then why would I, if that creates dukkha to be, have relationships with other people, well, I should not have any relationships with other people. I'm not saying that at all. It's like the whole richness of life has to do with relationship. I was just talking to a few people today, and tomorrow is our 48th wedding anniversary. 48 years together, my wife and I. And it's like, my God, how lucky I am. I'm stunned by how lucky I am. Right? But who knows whether tomorrow either of us will still be here. I don't know that. If I think I know that, that's when I'm going to really hurt. I hope so. We're planning to go for a nice dinner. So, I mean, to my favorite Mexican restaurant, no less. I mean, so I hope so. So we still live in the world and have a life. But we have to be aware all the time that that's right, a possibility. So, you know, we can enjoy life but not cling to it. You know, there's that second noble truth. You know, we end up clinging to things. We think, no, I'm going to keep this. This is going to be mine. You know, and I'm going to keep it forever. But nothing is forever. You know, everything changes. And we cling to things because they make us feel that we have an identity, that's who I am. I'm the person who believes these things and has this stuff. That's how we create our sense of self over and over and over. We create a sense of solidity around what we believe in and who we're related to and how we're connected to things. We cling to all those things, including this sense of, you know, in the end, the most difficult thing to deal with, and I've got a lot of work on this one still, is we cling to the idea that I'm separate. I'm different somehow or other. I'm special. I'm different than all those other people, all those other beings. I'm separate somehow. I'm not, and we have to, you know, if we can let go of that, and we start to see the how much we're the same as everyone else, then that sense of separateness starts to dissolve, which is why another reason for these five remembrances, because this is not like, well, this is what it's going to be like for me, but those other people are going to have different stuff. This is universal. This is something that everyone experiences without exception. And so we're all in the same boat. We're all connected by this truth that can't be avoided. And that's another reason I think I like this. I like this thought, is that this is like, this is what makes us all human and all the same. You know, we may look different, we might have different, you know, hair colors and different nationalities and speak different languages and all kinds of different differences. And we can either focus on the differences, makes them different from me, or we can focus on the similarity, which is, this is what everyone experiences without exception. We're all the same. No exceptions. None at all. Including me. I have to remember, I can't accept myself from these rules, too. This is just the way things are. So the idea of the First Noble Truth is, this is the fact. This is the fact. We can't avoid it. We can't ignore it. We can't pretend it's not there. We can't pretend we're an exception. If we can take that in and start to live every moment, every day, with that embedded in our heart, and how we're interacting with everyone else, and how we're seeing ourselves in relation to everyone else, then we start seeing how the clinging to any of this stuff is totally useless. What a waste of time and energy. And that allows us to actually wake up in the true sense of awakening, which is the Third Noble Truth, of course. This is where we're headed. This is where this practice leads. You know, I was just reading some other stuff about people who are teaching things like MBSR and all kinds of other forms of mindfulness practice, all of which are wonderful. You know, and from a psychological point of view, I'm sure they're very helpful. But in the end, my concern with all those practices is they forget this. Don't want to talk about this. This is too scary to talk about. You know, let's not upset people. You know, but this is the truth, without exception. That's what connects us together, and then we can actually start having the calmness and steadiness and the pleasantness of that calmness and steadiness, because we're no longer caught in this pattern of belief that somehow I'm the exception. Somehow this doesn't apply to me or to the person, those people I'm so close to, for that matter. Whether it's a person or my dog or my cat or, you know, my goldfish, doesn't matter. We somehow, like, the rules don't apply there, please. I don't want those rules to apply to them. But they do. This is, you know, often we see the phrase non-attachment. This is what we're talking about. We're being not attached to anything, any idea, any concept, anything other than I'm moving towards awakening. And that's the intent of my having this body and functioning in the world. And we get to this, and then you go, well, what's left? What's left of all? If none of this is relevant, what's left? You know, that's like, we get to this state, so I understand. And now I'm talking from what people have told me as opposed to personal deep knowledge. Get this state where all that's there is the knowing itself. We know, but we know just what's arising. This now, there's this now, there's this. We start to see it all as just everything flowing by, and we're connected to it all by knowing it. But that's it. There's just the knowing. And the danger of this, it's always the yellow warning flag, is that we can become attached to that sense of knowing. Because until it's like we're absolutely knowing, until we're actually truly enlightened, completely enlightened, as opposed to moments of enlightenment or little periods of enlightenment, it's very easy to get attached to this extremely, so they tell me, pleasant experience of just pure knowing, where there's no sense of separate body. And I just want to read something from Joseph Goldstein here. And this is from his book, Mindfulness. And he's talking about what this state is like, and then he points out something here. In the meditative process, sometimes all objects seem to disappear, and all that's left is consciousness, this pure knowing. The knowing mind. But care is needed here because there can be a subtle attachment to this state and identification with awareness itself. So there's nothing left except just this knowing process. But in and of itself, it's something we can get attached to. It's yet another thing that we think, oh, this is great. I'll hang out here. But care is needed here because there can be a subtle attachment to this state and identification with awareness itself. This becomes an interesting place of investigation. We can notice how easy it is to make a home of awareness and have a sense of self settle right in. Consciousness is not a thing that exists, but an event that occurs. Consciousness. I want to read that again. Consciousness is not a thing that exists, but an event that occurs. So consciousness, just like everything else, arises and then goes away. Right? The question then arises, how can we cut through this subtle identification with knowing with consciousness? Different traditions use different methods. As mentioned earlier, Mahasi Sayadaw, who was one of Joseph's teachers, describes this state very clearly and reminds meditators to keep noting the knowing mind until one goes beyond even knowing. So we think of this knowing mind as the end, and we get attached to it because it's so wonderful to be there, and we can't let go of it. And then there's this description, this is from the sutta, of where that ends. There is, monks, an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned. If, monks, there were no unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, no escape from would be discerned from what is born, become, made, and conditioned. But because there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, therefore, an escape is discerned from the born, become, made, and conditioned. In other words, at some point, you can all those things where we think that things are solid, where we cling to them, we start to, something happens and we shift to see that none of it is there in the absolute sense. Joseph goes on, these moments of consciousness that take nibbana as their object are called path and fruition. The path moment, likened to a sudden flash of lightning that illuminates the sky, has the power to completely uproot certain defilements from the mind so they don't arise again, and to weaken defilements that remain. In other words, before we have this total enlightenment, whatever that is, we can only vaguely imagine it, we have moments where we have these times where we're knowing in the purest sense that as he's describing here. And the things that prevent us from going deeper just fall away. So that what he's calling defilements, things that get in the way, things, beliefs, things that we're still clinging to, we stop clinging to them. We just let them, they just go. And it's not like we're consciously letting them go, they just go. They're not there anymore. And over time, what happens is we let go of all of it. You know, and the Buddha describes his moment of enlightenment. He said, just before he was totally enlightened, he realized he still clung to a subtle sense of self, a subtle sense of separateness. And once he let that go, then enlightenment arose. So, And so when in the sutta, when he says we should know this, you know, I mean, remember what the sutta says. It says, he knows it really is. This is the cessation of dukkha. In other words, at some point, we will actually experience, not in an intellectual way, but experience the cessation of dukkha. That at times it just stops. Sometimes just in little bits, and then a little bit more, and a little bit more, and then it stops. That's what we have to move towards and somehow manage that. And then, but then even there it says, he knows this really is, this is the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. So we see that there's a method, a path, you know? And Joseph had something to say about that too that I also wanted to share. It's not insignificant that the Buddha called this last of the noble truths a path. The implication is these eight consecutive steps lead somewhere, that there is a final goal, although the notion of goal can sometimes lead to overstriving, to a kind of spiritual ambition that gets in the way of realization. This overstriving has more to do with how we are practicing rather than the understanding that there is indeed an end to dukkha. It's how we practice that we have to be aware of. René Dumas, in his book Mount Analog, Joseph is a favorite book of Joseph's, he keeps referencing it in other places too. René Dumas, in his book Mount Analog, describes the crucial balance between living fully in the moment and at the same time keeping the vision of our final destination. So this whole book is an analog about climbing a mountain. Keep your eyes fixed on the way to the top, but don't forget to look right in front of you. The last steps depend on the first. Don't think you've arrived just because you see the summit. That's up there someplace, right? Watch your footing and be sure of the next step But don't let that distract you from the highest goal. The first step depends on the last. So the last step depends on the first, and the first step depends on the last. So it's all connected together. It's all slowly moving in the same direction. That's what the Eightfold Path is all about, somehow. And that's really all I can say about this. I mean, it's something that we sort of have to take in and absorb over time, and have these little moments where, you know, things fall away and there's just knowing, and then even that knowing falls away and there's some other state that I don't even have words for, some non-dual state, because in the knowing there's me and there's the knowing. There's still a knower and the knowing, and that has to, that knower has to slip away, and there's just then some other form of pure knowing, or so they tell me. So what does this mean for our practice day to day? I think day to day, especially if this is what I'm saying makes sense to you, you know, really consciously looking at and thinking about and taking in, even if it's just simply repeating the five remembrances at some regular way, or going into situations where you're exposed every day or daily or weekly or whatever to the situation. This is what's happening to all these people. This is why I'm a chaplain at the hospital and why I did 9 years of hospice work before that. Because it's like, it's practice. It's like, this, look, this is what happens. It's really clear. This is what happens to everyone. Because you see it right there in front of your eyes. And you sit with people and they talk about, in hospice work, I spent a lot of time talking to people who would say, like, well, I used to be able to go for a walk every day. And I really loved going for walks every day. And now I can't. I don't have enough strength anymore to go for a walk. All I can do is sit in this chair. And they're still mentally active, and I could, you know, we'd have talk, and they would reminisce about all those wonderful things in the past, but they couldn't go for a walk anymore. Your life, all those things you think are important, close in. And hanging out with people whose lives are like that, whose lives are literally closing in, is a real powerful way to experience the five remembrances right there in front of you. And so I'm not saying you should do this. I'm just saying that for me that's what's worked. So everybody can all find ways to make this somehow real. Our culture puts so much energy into avoiding having to look at these things, into avoiding having to deal with them in any way. But we can't avoid them. So perhaps we need to instead seek out ways to take them in. It's practice in the broadest sense. Then on the moment-to-moment practice, just more and more and more, if we can, start to actually tune into how everything we're experiencing in the moment. It's just something that arose, is there for a while, and it's gone. We start to see impermanence in little tiny moments, and then we slowly tie them all together and see that that's what's always there. I wish I had some more brilliant answer than that in terms of practice, but I don't. This just, well, seems to be what the Buddha pointed to anyway. So that's what I'm trying to do. So now it's time to actually sit and contemplate as best we can what I've just said. And at the same time, understand this is a long-term process, something we have to work with over the long term. And so those of you who might be listening to this recording, this is where we, once again, I'm going to say a few words to lead us into the sitting process. Then I'm going to be silent, then I'm going to turn off my mic, turn off the recording, and then I'll start up the recording again in a little while, and then I'll start talking a little bit more. So when I finish leading us into the sitting practice, just sit and turn off your recording for a little while, and then come back and we'll catch the rest of it. So just settling. Just being right now, right here, in this moment. We don't need anything. It doesn't have to be a certain way. We're not trying to make it be a certain way. We're just trying to see it. Know as it really is. This is what this moment is like. And this moment, which may be different from that moment. And so on. Just know as it really is. Just sit. So I have nothing more to say, other than I have a little bit of poetry to read at some point. So I just want to open the floor to all of you who've been so dedicated in coming to these events, this 9 weeks of teaching. And anything you'd like to share, anything you'd like to say, any questions you might have, just turn on your mic and go ahead. Kevin's already got his mic on.
Well, two questions. Where's the high jumper?
Oh, the high jumper is being hung in the North Boulder Rec Center tomorrow.
Oh, cool. All right.
Along with 9 other paintings from that time.
And the serious question, I think if I heard you right, and you probably said it before and it never connected, but or didn't connect the same way. But I think, did you say in the beginning this evening that intended actions can result in karma?
Yeah, that is basically, an action to result in karma, there has to have been intention.
So
to act or speak. So it's like, and someone bumps into you and your arm flings out and you spill coffee on them. That was unintentional. It just happened because, so you're not, there's no karma in you having spilled coffee on them. That sort of thing is what they're trying to point to.
Well, that's a great example. Because many years ago, I was in a very kind of like a street fair, nice, bustling city thing. And I went to point something. Oh, look at that.
Yeah.
And I struck this person who was behind me so hard.
Yeah.
I really felt awful. And that's I don't know, to me, that's an example of unintended consequences.
Unintended action. Yeah. But then how you then respond to that afterwards, that has intention usually. Like now you, oh, I just hit you, I'm sorry, and you, there's the intention, I'm back again, because you've made a choice to respond. But the actual action itself was totally unintended.
Right.
Yeah,
lot of unintended consequences going around today. So. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. Other comments, thoughts, questions? I love this teaching. It's something I struggle with myself. I mean, I only understand it to a certain extent. I'm sure I don't know it as it really is, all these things. But that's where I see where my practice is focused into somehow more deeply grasping this teaching. Just on some deeper, less intellectual, more experiential level, which is why I keep practicing, I suppose.
Yeah, it seems like it's more of a right brain, kind of activity going on, especially with this the Four Noble Truths at the end, and with the dying and the clearly knowing. I mean, it and to not look at it intellectually, it is experiential. I mean, and we all experience our own death. Nobody else can experience that for us.
Yeah.
But there is something very interesting that I've observed several times in my life working as a nurse, and then being with family members that passed away. There is a certain stillness in the air. There's something, it's like there's something there, but once the breath ceases,
yeah,
there's something still there, and it's very still and subtle.
Yeah. I've experienced the same thing many times, sitting with people.
Yeah, so it just, it's kind of a mystery.
Yeah, I think death is very mysterious. But it happens to everyone.
It does.
And some people it happens in very calm, sweet ways, and some people it's difficult right to the last moment. I've seen both of those. I'm sure you, being a nurse, have seen that too.
Yeah,
and I also know that there is that mode, that sort of that space where someone passes and it's like there's a transition happening. There's some significant. And the interesting thing is I experienced exactly the same thing being with both my wife and with other people who were friends as a baby was being born.
Exactly.
It's once again, it's a moment of transition. There's this, something is happening that's beyond my understanding, but it's like incredibly poignant, I think might be the right word. They can feel something that, and you can't explain it, you can't put a word for it, but it's like, oh, this is different.
Yeah, that's exactly, my mother passed away a couple of years ago, and at her memorial service, that's exactly how I explained it. I was with her. I was the only person other than the hospital chaplain that was also there. And that's exactly how I explained it. It was like, it was the same as a birth. It's almost like a miracle. There's a miracle happening. You know, I mean, you
Yeah.
can't explain it. But that's exactly what I said at the service. And, you know, I don't know if anybody or there understood what I was saying, but it sounds like we both experienced that in our lives
Yeah.
to recognize it.
I think a lot of people experience that. I don't think we're exceptions in any sense of the word. Maybe, yeah, we're maybe a little more tuned into it because of what we do. You worked as a nurse and I've worked as in hospice and that, so you experience it more often.
Yes, exactly. And it's more pleasant when the person that's dying is not fighting it. I've seen that too, and that is really a not, I mean, it's almost like just holding on and refusing to let go, and you can't stop it. It's gonna happen.
Yeah.
So, well, my sit tonight was not that pleasant because I kept thinking about, I mean, I tried to just focus on the breath, and then I would trail off into the talk that you gave and thinking about it and some more practice.
Yeah, don't we all? We all need more practice. Okay, thank you, Karen. Anyone else have anything they'd like to share? I have a favorite poem. One of my all-time favorite poems. It's one from Mary Oliver's book, Why I Wake Early. And it's called Snow Geese. And it describes to me so clearly what a moment of mindfulness is. So it's called Snow Geese. Oh, to love what is lovely and will not last. What a task to ask of anything or anyone. Yet it is ours, and not by the century or the years, but by the hours. One fall day I heard above me and above the sting of the wind a sound I did not know, and my look shot upward. It was a flock of snow geese, winging it faster than the ones we usually see, and being the color of snow, catching the sun, so they were, in part at least, golden. I held my breath, as we do sometimes to stop time. When something wonderful has touched us, as with a match which is lit and bright, but does not hurt in the common way, but delightfully, as if the light were the most serious thing you ever felt. The geese flew on. I've never seen them again. Maybe I will someday, somewhere. Maybe I won't. It doesn't matter. What matters is that when I saw them as through the veil, secretly, joyfully, clearly. And that's the other part. I mean, the word I love those last secretly, joyfully, and clearly. Clarity brings joy. Really knowing things as they really are. We sort of talked about it. And it's like, oh, it's all this grim stuff about death. Also brings joy because we're released from that weight of having to struggle with these things all the time and try to fix them because they're all unfixable. So all we can do is just live our lives and be joyful. And that's the other half of the Buddhist teaching. That all of this I've been talking about for the last whatever leads to joy. That's what this practice is about, is leading to more joy in our lives. And that comes with the realizations of, and understanding of the Buddhist teachings. That's all I have to share today.